This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. The dust still hasn't completely settled since May, when a 13-year-old won the Scripps National Spelling Bee with the word canadal.
Canadal or knadel, it's a dumpling.
As held it back.
Max hoped to find at least one more canadal in his soup bowl, but all he discovered was his missing lower denture.
Canadal. K. N. A. I. D. E. L. Canadal.
The crowd goes wild. You know, as a matter of fact, there's some buzz on the internet still as to whether the winning word was spelled correctly because it's a foreign word. Anyway, you can look that up. It's there. The fight goes on. But for many adults, watching the spelling bee is a nostalgic event. They wanted nothing more than to crush their opponents just the way they did in grade school. Except this time they can do it with beer in their hands. There's an adult spelling bee coming to Chapel Hill at Flyleaf Books this Friday at 6:30, co-sponsored by UNC's Humanity Program. Max Orr is associate director. We also have Peter Sokolowski, who is the editor-at-large for Merriam-Webster and a professional pronouncer. Welcome to both of you. Good to have you on the program.
Thank you so much.
It's great to be here.
Peter, let me start with you. I understand that adult spelling bees are not a new phenomenon. Tell us about spelling bees in America. Let's go back to the Revolutionary War. Kind of a big deal then, too, huh?
It goes to even before then. There is some evidence of spelling contests in English school books in the Elizabethan period, and they were kind of in the form of a quiz, one student quizzing another. But the sort of public way that we know today as the stand-up spelling bee was recommended by none other than Ben Franklin in the middle 18th century. Long before America was founded, in 1750, he wrote a treatise on children's education in which he recommended this practice to perfect spelling. And he also said something interesting. He said, you know, the winner should get a really good book as a prize.
Which, by the way, he would print.
I was going to say that's a publisher's talking, but at any rate, it does show that there was evidence of this kind of event taking place among children and in schools. There's also evidence in the 1760s that in Connecticut, the losing team of students would have to sweep the schoolhouse in the or bring in the firewood, so they'd have to do extra work. But what's also shown by research of Alan Walker Reed, the great mid-century linguist, showed that not too long after that, around the time of the Revolution and just after, adults also participated. They made the bees in the evening, partly so they could incorporate regional villages gathering together, and also partly so the adults could take place and could take part in the contest. And clearly, it was also a social event.
And Max, you're also a historian, and you've thought about this and looked into it a bit. And there is a kind of – these are not uniquely American, but there's a kind of uniquely American appeal that you think is part of this. Tell us about it.
Well, absolutely. The English language, as I'm sure Peter knows, is a conglomerate of many different languages. In a ways, it's the ultimate immigrant language. And, of course, we're an immigrant nation as well. So I think there's something very special about creating a sense of community around conventions of spelling. And I think these adult spelling bees are one way that, you know, as Peter was mentioning back in the past, when our nation is just developing a sense of community spirit, that spelling bees might have been part of that. Of course, it's a social event, but if we're all deciding how to communicate together and making sure that we are spelling words the same way, that is one small way of building community.
Kind of a democratic norm building for the new nation. But Peter, you talked about Elizabethan. I mean, spelling bees, the language wasn't settled by that time, was it? And the spellings are kind of all over the place.
You're very right about that, because the same word would be spelled many different ways, even by Shakespeare, for example. But in that sort of Socratic dialogue, in that it's a book called The English Schoolmaster from 1596, you have one student quizzing another, saying things like, "Why pronounce you not the E in the end of people?" And the answer is, "It draweth the syllable long, as H-A-T spelleth hat, H-A-T-E is hate." So there was already this sense of a beginning norm, but the real norm was established with the advent of a greater literacy, publication, and of course dictionaries, which set standards. And that's exactly what Max just mentioned. Noah Webster, who was a great patriot, wanted to identify a kind of national language and have that bond.
So, Max, why did you create this adult spelling bee out of the humanities department at the Augusta University of North Carolina?
Well, you know, our job is to be the public outreach arm of the College of Arts and Sciences, and we do all sorts of public programs, and they're very serious scholarly content. So it originally started with wanting to do something fun, frankly. We take a little break in the summertime. And so I talked with Jamie at Flyleaf Books. We have a great partnership with Jamie Fiocco. And she was the one who said, I've wanted to do a spelling bee, and my husband Michael and I have been wanting to do a spelling bee for a long time. And so we just seized on it and grabbed it, and we have a wonderful cast of professors who are going to be on our panel. And so, again, it's to have a good time. But there is one element that I think you need to pay attention to, and that is that although we're talking about spelling, and we're talking about how words are spelled, words themselves are important, and words are symbols that people will grab a hold of and think about. So, you know, if you teach someone a word like Affenpinscher, maybe they'll come across that dog at some point.
What's that word now?
Well, it's on my list. I will have to ask Peter if I'm pronouncing it correctly. It's a breed of dog with wiry hair. You put these words in people's minds, and it's sort of like synchronicity. The next moment, they'll see that word, and it'll become part of their lives. And so there is something that it's a very small way of touching the humanities and bringing literacy and knowledge of language and words to the forefront.
Peter, are you both a pronouncer and a chooser?
I do take part a little bit in picking the words for certain bees. There's three kind of bees to me as a professional. There's the kind of spelling bee for kids who are learning English as a second language. And I've done these all over the world, especially in Korea, where now English language study is mandated by law for all students starting at around the age of 10. And so the National Spelling Bee in Korea is kind of a big deal. And also in Brazil and in India and other places. And so there's a list that we use that are words that are likely to be encountered by these students in their reading, not the gotcha kind of words that you might hear in the National Spelling Bee in Washington, D.C., which really is the full dictionary as the rule book. That is to say, our big 473,000 unabridged dictionary is the source of all the words for the National Spelling Bee, and truly any word in that book is viable. And for adult bees, I like to use words that basically everyone has heard before. It's no fun if you're just picking these words out of a hat that no one's ever used or heard pronounced out loud. But Max said something interesting. It's really true that once you hear a word or learn a word, the likelihood is you'll encounter that word in the next day or week, and it always happens to me.
Yeah, because you've been ignoring that word the whole time. You didn't know what it meant, particularly if it takes up a lot of space on the page, that particular word. Max, how about the contestants in this case? How are they chosen?
Well, we're going to do it draw out of a hat. People can show up as early as 6. The doors officially open at 6:30 and put their name in. We're going to have both individual competition and team competitions. And the team competitions will be filler in between the rounds of the individual competitions. We're going to pick 15 individuals and as many teams as want to compete. And the teams are going to be interesting because we're going to have one option where each member of the team will say one word, and once it falls apart, the team loses, and perhaps also some word games and whatnot. And those will be sort of filler between the official rounds.
Well, I thought each contestant would take a syllable, and then you'd put them all together. Peter, what about pronunciation? That has always been a sticking point, you know, and in this business, we spend a lot of time, and news organizations have their kind of pronunciation guides. You can get into these fights over François Mitterrand and Paris and broad and caught. How do you? What's your the definitive decider for you pronouncers?
Well, the decider is the printed pronunciation key that we put next to each word. And now that may be a reflection of the most commonly heard version of the word, but it also may reflect several commonly heard versions. And so I make sure, as does Jacques Bailey, who is the pronouncer at the National Spelling Bee, I make sure to warn a speller that, for example, the word I'm about to say has a homograph or a homonym, a word that sounds exactly like it. For example, I heard him do this with the word nuke. And I'm sure all of us immediately picture in our mind N-U-K-E, nuke. But he warned the speller. He said, there's a word that sounds just like this one. Here's the word. It's nuke. And the speller had prepared her mind to think of maybe an alternate spelling. And then when she asked for the dictionary definition, she realized that this has to refers to an anatomical spot at the bottom of the back of your neck. So she spelled it correctly, N-U-Q-U-E. So the fact is, it's very tricky with these multiple pronunciations. Also, I warn spellers if there are multiple correct pronunciations, like, for example, vaudeville and vaudeville. They're both correct. They're both listed in the dictionary. But, you know, the second of my pronunciations just there gives you a huge clue as to the spelling of the word. And the pronouncer's role, I have to emphasize, is not adversarial. It's to help the speller.
Well, and this gets to, I guess, the importance of knowing the country of origin as well. But beyond that, and all of that points to whether or not being able to spell correlates to anything in the intellect. As a defender of my own intellect against my inability to spell, I've been on a crusade, a lifelong crusade.
I would say that there is something to be said about we're in this moment where people are texting a lot. We have spell check on our computers, which has really sort of cut people's ability to spell in half. I mean, that's completely undocumented, or maybe it helps them. But it certainly seems that we don't pay attention to this as much anymore. And you'll see also one of the sort of the trolling on comments. Oh, you misspelled there. It's the other there or whatnot. So I do think there is something to be said for a very basic level of getting people to think about proper spelling of words. And again, to reinforce that communication that's so important.
But in a living language, Peter, don't those spellings change because of pronunciation? So maybe someday, because we don't say brought and caught anymore, at least in this part of the world, we're going to drop the O-U-G-H-T or the O-U-G-H-T.
You're exactly right. And, you know, knicht, the old pronunciation of the word knight, as in knight in shining armor, or even the word apron, which originally came from the French word nap, meaning napkin, basically. Mm. And so what happened in English is you say, give me an apron became napkin. And so we have napkin on the one hand and apron on the other, and they have these sort of shared history. But you realize we trimmed one word sort of after the N and one word before it. And so pronunciation absolutely does influence things. And, you know, Frank, you have an excellent point that to a certain extent, in isolation, English orthography is one of the last great shibboleths, because all it really proves is that you know how to spell the word. It doesn't prove that you know how to use the word, for example, and it doesn't prove that you know what it means when you encounter it. But it's also true that it's hard to isolate these things, so that this kind of organization of the mind, whereby we ascribe Latin or French or Germanic origins to these words, they're really great intellectual baggage to carry around, because that's the way we organize our thought in the final analysis.
So where does this word B-E-E come from? Spelling bee, quilting bee, sewing bee.
Right, exactly. It doesn't come from the animal. We're almost certain that the word does not refer to the buzzing insect, even though that's a kind of an appealing idea, because the buzzing insect is industrious and can probably study really well and works well on teams, although spelling bees are often individual competitions. No, it comes from the Middle English word bene, which is the origin of our word boon, which means a favor or voluntary help given to neighbors, you know, toward the accomplishment of a particular task. Boon, which means blessing, and can mean benefit or favor. And so we just simply have this this holdover from that word bene, and we pronounce it B now. Now, folk etymology is a real phenomenon, and that's sort of part of what you were talking about, Frank. If this word looks like B and it sounds like B, a lot of people are going to treat it like B, and there's a tendency in that case to have it drift in terms of pronunciation toward the existing insect sound. So we think that this is a word that comes from bene, that was influenced by the other word, B.
Aha, and it's a good thing. And when neighbors got together and helped, that's sort of the idea here. Beer and drinking is also a part of those neighbors
and
getting together.
And start with B, you just
beer
put an R.
Yeah. Beer, it's a drinking beer. That's what it was originally, and we dropped the R. No.
First of all, I think Peter needs to be at the spelling bee on Friday night. I think we're going to need some of this expertise. It's going to be a joyous occasion for sure.
All right. I love adult spelling bees because they are so much fun, and they're a little bit more low-key. One of my favorite ones was held at a bookstore in Washington, D.C. We do it on a regular basis, and the winner will be familiar to you, Melissa Block. And she turns out to be a phenomenal speller, and she beat all comers. And that was at Politics and Prose, and there was indeed beer served.
B-L-O-C-H. That surprises you, doesn't it, Melissa
That's
Block?
Right.
So she won. I will lose. Let's do it now. Let's get this over with. The staff insisted that you quiz me.
Sure.
And it really doesn't matter what. If you give me a word that ends in A-N-C-E or E-N-C-E, I'll spell it wrong. I do it 100% of the time. But anyway, but pick a hard word. It'll be fun for our audience.
Peter, I have a word that's easy. I'm sure you brought some words. Would you like to start?
No, you go ahead.
Okay. I have a word that's pretty common. The word is truncheon. It means a policeman's club.
Truncheon. T-R-U-N-C-H-E-O-N.
Bing!
Correct. Did I get that right?
You did indeed.
Excellent. Got that one right. I spent a lot of time on the front lines in the 60s. Go ahead.
Peter, do you want to take one?
Sure. Here's a commonly misspelled word. It's a common word. Sacrilegious.
Sacrilegious. S-A-C-R-I-L-I-G-O-N. I-O-U-S. No, no, there's no I. O-U-S. Anyway, I spelled it wrong, didn't I? Sacrilegious.
Well, that's right. It's the schwa. You misspelled it because the E is the letter that follows the L, not I.
Oh, it's sacrilegious, not
sacrilegious. And because it doesn't conform to the word religious, and that's what's funny about this one. This is where your etymology comes into play. It's sacer, meaning holy or sacred, and legum or legus, meaning stolen. And so so that if you know the root of the word, then you know that the second part has an E and that's how you spell the word in your mind as you go.
Etymology, the study of words. Entomology, the study of industrial baked goods. Go ahead. One more, please. I think we got
this. This is not as common a word, but it's short. And the word is viscid.
Can I have a definition?
And it means sticky.
So it's so like visceral and viscous. So viscid would have a C and not an S. Viscosity. No, it would have an S. So viscid would be V-I-S-C-I-D. Bing! Wow, I get 2 out of 3, and I think I'm going to quit on that. I want to thank you both for being on the program today. Peter Sokolowski is editor of Merriam-Webster and a pronouncer at Spelling Bees. Max Orr, associate director of the Program of Humanities at UNC and a lecturer in History Department. The Adult Spelling Bee, Flyleaf Books, Friday at 6:30. There'll be details all over the place, including our website, wunc.org. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.